prices in order to decrease prices.
Exactly. Just follow through on the logical implications of those two extremely true core statements.
Laid it out so clearly.
You barely have to even explain. It is so clear what we should do and how general affordability is achievable if you just follow our policy prescriptions of deregulations, financial handouts for builders, and cutting protections for people who are allegedly vulnerable. But if you do the statistics, you know, something like 15% of them actually could afford higher rents.
Right.
On a closing note here, I think my key point would be that there is such a thing as general economic efficiency, and that the way to tell when things are allocated correctly is through a single variable thing called a price.
That's what's so beautiful about it. It encompasses all other variables in one variable, so you don't have to think about everything else. It's just simple, clean.
So if to restate that, there is something called economic efficiency, and when things are misallocated, it's because they're not being allocated to the rules and logic of prices under our economic system. Any evidence that allocations are out of sync are themselves proof that something called inefficiency has happened, because it is just tautologically true that if someone is paying a lower price than they might be willing to pay, it means that that thing is being given to someone who needs it less, desires it less, or is less socially valuable to receive it.
Right.
I think that's kind of my big point here.
If you're willing to pay more for something, it means you value it more. It means you get a better value out of it, no matter what. And to all the listeners out there who have economically illiterate friends, family members, people out there, you know, don't despair. This is an educational issue. Some of these things really are counterintuitive, but I hope that we've given you the toolkit to go out there today and say, here's why we need to keep prices high in order to reduce prices on rent. We've laid it out extremely clearly, and now it's your turn to go out there and spread the word, and let's make change happen.
Yeah, so when you're talking about this, ignore any of the benefits or complexities of the issue when talking about positive sides of rent control, and talk about the negatives, but in a way that's kind of a telephone game where you actually misrepresent what the studies say by creating a type of common sense that goes beyond what the studies can actually prove, and treat those things as unquestioned assumptions for further discussion.
Yeah, the studies are really just support for the model. The model is what comes first. There's a thing called supply and a thing called demand. And if you don't respect that, then you don't respect reality. And yeah, the studies, you know, a lot of them line up with what we want. Some of them don't. That's just the real world. It's a bit messy. But focus on the model first.
To not focus on the model first is equivalent to like climate change denial, evolutionary denial, any other sort of objective science. It's exactly the same.
Yeah, just like climate models.
So sign up on the Real Economics Tough Talk podcast Patreon, and we'll see you all next time. Don't forget to tip your landlord, because you don't know what they're going through right now, and you can't even imagine.
And to all my tenants out there listening who tipped me last month, thank you.
You can think of signing up on our Patreon as a kind of general purpose landlord tip for landlord education and the advancement of landlord interests. It's an indirect tip that will deliver big revenues to all landlords down the road as we increase economic education and literacy.
Wow, that was a bad show.
Yeah, I disagree with that podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
Here at Seriously Wrong, which the podcast we are both hosts of, that we're about to
record of our... that, you want to start recording it and just hit play and welcome everybody to the Seriously Wrong podcast.
Sorry, did you hit play or did you hit record?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right. I'll hit record. Welcome everybody to the Seriously Wrong podcast.
Oh, it's too bad we lost that take. That was a really good...
Well, you know, it's can't win them all. My name is Aaron, and...
My name's Sean.
We are talking this week about rent control.
Yeah, and before we get into that, I want to thank sincerely everyone for listening, and people who donate to the show, participate in the Seriously Wrong Discord community, and so on. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it.
There's a highlight from a new episode of Seriously Wrong. Find new episodes of the internationally acclaimed utopian leftist comedy show at seriouslywrong.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Pullback has been exploring ideas that address global problems like inequality and climate change with hosts Kylie Houston in Vancouver and Kristen Pugh in Ottawa since 2019. On this highlight from a recent episode, University of Calgary, Cummings School of Medicine, Sustainability, Disability, and Ability Studies scholar Gregor Wolbring joins the show to discuss ways the climate movement can be more inclusive. Now, here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to Pullback, where we ask experts to explain big ideas so you get the full story behind the hype. Pullback is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network of Progressive Canadian Podcasts. I'm Kyla Houston. I'm here with my co-host, Kristen Pugh. How are you, Kristen?
I'm, you know, just floating along in this dumpster fire of a timeline. How are you?
Whoa, coming out swinging.
No, I'm good.
We're on vacation, you know? Kristen's obviously been watching the news, but I haven't. Although I have been editing a lot of Tech Won't Save Us, so it's not like I'm completely uninformed. Paris does a great job of journalism. But we do have an episode for everybody. This is part of our climate series that we did in our last season. Kristen, do you want to introduce our guest?
Yeah. So just a reminder for folks, we're doing a couple bonus episodes that sort of focus on gaps that we saw from the season itself. And so the first one, I think it was a really good conversation. You can go listen to it on youth climate justice. The one today is on disability climate justice. And we spoke with Gregor Wolbring, who is a professor at the University of Calgary in disability and ability studies. So Gregor is really, you know, knowledgeable, also just one of those people that is like so enthusiastic and willing to share knowledge. I really enjoyed speaking with him.
Yeah, he was so lovely and also just a really lovely person. I'm having a great time editing this episode, and I'm sure that our listeners will really enjoy it.
Yeah, I also like that he calls his like students the wolf pack.
He's
that
just
speaks to me.
Such a charming human being. And we've covered disability justice a couple of times on the podcast, but it's the sort of subject that you really can't say too much about. And so I was really delighted that Kristen was able to bring on another fantastic guest. It's, you have a skill. And we're very excited to bring you a new season soonish. We're reaching out to people now, and we're going to start recording in the next month or two. So maybe not an immediate release, but certainly it is in the pipeline and on its way.
Should we tease the theme of the season?
Sure. You're so much better at describing things than me that maybe you should do it. You have a way with words that I do not.
Well, that feels unfair because the season was like, this is your idea and it's a really good idea. So I'll just give you full credit, but sure.
And then every subject is basically Kristen, except for the ones that are weird and unreally thought out. Those ones will be mine.
So Kyla had this really awesome thought that was, for next season, let's talk about ideas that just need more money. So maybe they're not new ideas, but they're ideas that maybe we don't have enough attention to or that are really underfunded. So I guess we can give you an example that is not one that's going to be in the season, but that we do think is really important. Schools need more money. Teachers need more money. It's interventions that matter, that make a positive difference in life, where we've got a lot of evidence that they work, but we just like are not giving them enough support or attention.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. And the reason we can't give you a real example from the upcoming season is because we haven't locked in an episode yet, but we're working on it. So if you hear this episode and you're like, hey, I work for an organization that could use a lot of money, I mean, reach out to us. We're open.
Yeah, we love getting suggestions for episodes. If you are somebody that wants to be on the show and you are, maybe you work in an area that's like really underfunded but does really good work, let us know.
Yeah, we're open to it. No promises, because we actually already do have a full lineup. But as you can see, we always do bonus episodes and we love featuring awesome people. So hit us up. Otherwise, enjoy this episode.
Thank you, Gregor, so much for speaking with us today. To start with, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your research at the University of Calgary?
Yes. So I'm faculty in Community Rehab Disability Studies. Well, normally I describe myself as an ability studies, disability studies, science and technology governance studies, sustainability studies scholar. So I'm fairly broad in what I do. I mean, but in the end, all is somehow linked to A, disabled people, their lived realities, And I mean, in essence, uses the ability framework, I mean, through everything. Yeah, and I do that since, I mean, 2008 as a faculty member. But, I mean, I do disability politics literally since I'm born, right? I mean, being a thalidomide person, we were all the time, I mean, right, all the time disability issues. So I do that, I mean, for a long time.
You're a great person to talk to about disability climate justice, which is our theme for today. But just to get us started, can you talk a little bit about what research has found about how disabled people are disproportionately negatively affected by climate change?
I mean, it makes sense that disabled people are disproportionately impacted. If there are fires, if there are floodings, if there are, I mean, it doesn't matter what on climate change. I mean, if you're impacted in your normal daily life, then obviously as soon as something goes wrong in general, you're impacted even more. For example, when we have all the fires right in recent years, the evacuation centers are normally not set up for disabled people. There's a huge amount of, but I mean, academic literature by disability studies scholars since 2008, right when I published on it, which highlights literally from one disaster to the next where there are problems from Katrina, right, which I used in my as a quote from in my 2009 climate change paper, where in essence it was at a hearing where it was about a disabled woman in her wheelchair was drowning. And she drowned because no one was picking her up, because no one was in the emergency evacuation policies. No one was responsible for picking up disabled people in their houses. And then she simply drowned in her wheelchair in a house, right? And then there was a U.S. news item around the Los Angeles fires. And same thing. They didn't go in there, and so the people simply burned in their house. So that is now decades apart, but the premise is the same. The evacuation procedures are simply not up to snuff, right? And one could go on, right? There's so much there, and it makes sense. If you are, as a so-called normative, ability normative person, have problems, then obviously then the ones, if you're not ability normative, you have even more problems. We know heat waves. Heat waves, the number one killer, I mean, around heat waves is nursing homes. And elderly people and so on, again, they don't have a certain resistance. And we have no good place, right, how we can, I mean, as to what we do in heat waves with them. And that's, of course, also with disabled people. If they also have a illness where they are less resistant to high heat, a lot of buildings, if you rent something, they don't allow that you put in a cooling unit because the electric grid of a, right, especially if it's apartment blocks, they're not made. If then everyone puts all by sudden cooling units into their places, right, gets overloaded, they will, I mean, the fuses will just burn, right?
There's really sort of a range of ways that disabled people are impacted disproportionately about climate change. But one of the things that you've sort of highlighted in your work is the importance of thinking about ableism and disableism as being sort of a cause of that disproportionate impact. So I'm wondering if, first of all, can you talk a little bit about what ableism and disableism mean, and then some of the main ways that they sort of come up in the context of climate change?
Ableism means that we see certain abilities as essential, and it's normally linked to disabled people. So when I coined the field of ability studies back in 2008, I went beyond that. I see ability judgments as the general cultural reality. Right? Fiona Campbell, with studies in ableism, coined that in 2008, focused more on disabled people, and then there's Dan Goodley. These are the three main strands of ability-based studies, I would say. Now, when I coined this as the general cultural reality, it's because I was trying to find a way to that I can literally do, I mean, it doesn't matter what topic shows up academically, I can put my two cents to it. And I come from the cyborg area, where in essence the cyborg is in the, well, in essence, right, the humans who are not enhanced beyond their species typical are seen as diseased. So the idea is there is a timeline. Certain abilities pop up and people are sniggering, right? I mean, it's eclectic, it's, I mean, outlandish. Then some of them make it into the next stage where people see them as, well, they actually might have some utility. They're not as outlandish as we maybe thought. So this becomes an, what I call ability expectation, nice to have. Then we have this where certain things become, certain abilities become essential to have, right? That's ableism, where you judge certain abilities as essential to have. And then certain abilities become obsolete. They were essential, but they're not anymore, right? Ability obsolescence. Prime example is the Luddites, right? All the way back, UK history, right? The weavers, right? Who felt when the steam-powered looms would replace them with their abilities. Their abilities they had, which for which they had then a living outcome, were all by sudden obsolete. Another example which leads to where we see new abilities are expected, which then labels people who don't have them as deficient, is the very term learning disability. Up to 1963, there was no term learning disability in the US-Canadian context. But the Americans changed requirements in schools. After Sputnik went up into orbit by the Russians, and then the Americans changed because they needed more STEM students, right? Science, technology, engineering, math students. And then they changed requirements in schools. And then a lot of kids who up to then were totally ability normative couldn't cut it anymore. And then they coined for them, of course, not the phrase learning disability as an ability variation of learning, but as a neurological disorder.
There's a new episode of Pullback. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. This episode is brought to you by the new Between the Lines Books release, Strangely Friends, A History of Cuban-Canadian Encounters. And finally, Sierra Club Canada's The Environment in Canada is a weekly podcast exploring climate change, biodiversity, renewable energy, and democracy with hosts Jessica Murray in Toronto and Connor Curtis in Montreal. On this highlight from a recent episode, The Energy Mix's Mitchell Beer joins the show to explain why solution-focused energy reporting is more important now than ever. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to another episode of the Environment in Canada podcast, a podcast about the environment in Canada by Sierra Club Canada. I'm Connor Curtis, Head of Communications with Sierra Club Canada, and today I'm going to be talking with Mitchell Beer, publisher of The Energy Mix, which, if you haven't heard of it before, is one of the best sources for energy and climate news in Canada. Now, this interview is actually from September 2024, and this episode is coming out in 2025. Obviously, a lot has changed in that time, but our conversation about energy journalism remains really, really relevant to coverage now. As the interview itself is from a little while ago, though, I wanted to start this episode by reading you something more recent from the Energy Mix, and through that reading, hopefully give you an example of the sort of coverage they are doing. So before jumping into the interview, here are a couple of excerpts of an article by Mitchell Beer from July 6, 2025, entitled Oil is Faltering, Renewables Will Survive Trump, What is Carney's Next Move? You wouldn't know it from scanning through your daily dose of morning headlines, but we're witnessing the beginning of the end of oil and gas. And industry executives know it, even if they can't or won't say it out loud. When Canada's oil sands and pipeline titans tout a new generation of fossil fuel infrastructure, when Donald Trump tries to command industry action, and I mean now on his drill baby drill agenda, they're pushing against two realities that are beyond their control. Weak fossil fuel demand is driving down the oil and gas prices on which the industry's profits rise or fall. We'll see those prices spike from time to time for the foreseeable future, but they won't run high enough for long enough to pay for the multi-billion-dollar mega projects the industry is promoting. The cheapest, quickest, most reliable way to meet new energy demand is with renewable sources like wind and solar, energy storage, and energy efficiency, particularly smaller decentralized sources that can be matched to local needs and help communities and businesses build resilience against the next local heat wave, flood, or power outage. The world's largest oil companies have endured a lost decade in the stock market, struggling to convince investors that they can grow in a world where demand for their main product is expected to peak in coming years, the Financial Times reported in mid-June, citing a conclusion in the International Energy Agency first published in May 2021. Oil majors are no strangers to boom and bust cycles, the Times added. But now the challenge may be structural. The rapid adoption of electric vehicles, especially in China, has surpassed the industry. Many oil majors now concede that production will probably peak within the next decade. So colossal fossils like ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Norway's Equinor are now working to squeeze every molecule, in the words of Equinor's CEO Anders Opedal, before the music stops. Equinor isn't alone. Every fossil company everywhere wants investors, governments, and citizens to think, even against the thinnest of evidence, it will be the last one standing as its business steadily crashes. But times are already tough, and the tell comes from two of the industry's biggest voices, a branch of the U.S. Federal Reserve and the world's oil and gas cartel. The full 2025 article by Mitchell I just read from can be found in the Energy Mix's Weekender on Substack. I'll link to it below. Now, without further ado, here's that interview from 2024.
Thank you for joining me today. For those tuning in, who are you and what do you do?
Thanks for having me here, Connor. I'm the publisher of The Energy Mix, which is a community news website and e-digest series on climate change, energy, and the shift off carbon. We've just celebrated 10 years of pretty much continuous publishing. And if you told me a decade ago that I'd be going around saying that, I would have thought that was somewhere between hilarious and terrifying, but here we are. Mm. And Energy Mix Productions is also one of the two lead partners in the Green Resilience Project, which is a series of local listening sessions across Canada at the intersection between income insecurity, local resilience, and climate solutions.
It's a lot of really valuable work. I'm curious, looking at the media landscape right now, what do you see as some of the challenges and perhaps some of the gaps that need to be addressed in journalism covering environmental topics?
Well, actually, I'm glad you asked that. The 101 media coverage out there in both Canada and the US has been getting a lot better over the last two or three years. And there are a lot of examples that start with news outlets like the CBC, the Toronto Star, the Washington Post in the U.S. I don't know how current this information is with some of the staff changes they've been going through. But at one point, while they were in the midst of broader layoffs, they expanded their climate newsroom to 30 or more people, which is mind-blowing. I mean, you'll hear stories about climate coverage and commitments to climate coverage going on in general media. And more than once, I've had this reaction. We've actually lived to see this day. It's really changed this much. There's always a need for more in-depth coverage, for more investigative coverage. But bear in mind as well that media everywhere, local media, national media, everything in between, have been gutted. It's been a decade or more now since journalism's really had a financing model that works for it, conventional journalism or any journalism. And that's not just on climate and the environment. They just don't have the resources a lot of the time to get out there. So newsrooms are getting cut back, local news outlets are shuttering. And I mean, that's bad news for climate coverage. It's bad news for democracy, bad news for communities. And it's something I think everybody is really still scrambling to sort out. In our own coverage, partly because we think the 101 is being done pretty well out there, we've really been shifting our focus over the last few years to the what and the why of climate change and climate solutions to the how we actually get it done. We're never going to get 100% consensus out there that climate change is the thing. And thankfully, I don't think we need 100% consensus to win. What we do need, though, is to engage with audiences and communities that can have a disproportionate impact in driving faster, deeper carbon cuts. Whether those audiences are activists determined to make a difference or city managers trying to figure out how the procurement department gets online with this. Right? It's all of those things, everything in between. Once we get beyond, we have to get that emergency declaration declared. We have to get that 2040 target established and that 2030 target tightened up. Once we've done that important work, the really complicated detail that follows is, okay, don't think twice. How do we actually implement this? And that's the how. So there are so many interesting stories to be told, conversations to be had, and complicated progress to be made. And I think that's something that media at any level can and should be focusing on. The one other piece that I'll trust you to cut out of this answer if it's getting too long is that we're starting to get really interested in, where necessary, how to restore, but where it still exists, how to mobilize local media. There was a study out of UCLA, I think over the last 6 to 8 weeks, and we covered it in our news digest, where they found that support for local infrastructure projects depended very much on whether the story was told locally or nationally. And they didn't specifically say green infrastructure, but you can imagine that if you're sitting in Kamloops and you see another news story, rather, about billions of dollars going into federal investment tax credits, depending on your own political persuasion, depending on how your day is going so far, your reaction might be, oh, great, there's Ottawa with its hand in my pocket again. But if the news story is, we're finally getting this footbridge that we've been trying to get funded for decades, you all remember how long we've been wanting this, and it means that you will have a 20-minute shorter commute each way each day. Mm-hmm. And for bonus points, your daughter can actually bike safely because it includes a bike lane. Mm-hmm. Right? Suddenly that $5 or $10 million local investment is so much more meaningful to you than the $5 or $10 billion tax credit at the federal level. And it helps build understanding that, yeah, climate action is about local solutions that go way beyond the emission reductions. So honestly, sure, what we're doing with this, yeah, I have a few ideas. But getting those local stories seeded and told and supported is an area where I think none of us really have the resources to do the work. And something really promising where media can step up, given the dollars and given the staffing and the expertise.
Well, and it's interesting just to take a bit of a tangent on that. And we had another episode where we talked about sentiments around taxation, right? People maybe are really anti-taxation when they don't see any benefit to it, when they think that it's just the money is going in and nothing's coming out, and they don't see what the actual benefits are. And there might be just criticism sometimes for that too, right? Like, it's not like every tax dollar gets spent in a way that is perfect. I mean, how many millions of dollars are we giving away in funding for carbon capture storage that's not going anywhere, right? But corporate profits.
There's Hey, can I tell you, well, pipeline is called Trans Mountain.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, if you're concerned about your tax dollars, there are definitely just criticisms to make, right? And so it's not like that argument is wrong. It's just there are also places where, obviously, I mean, we live in a country where we do taxation, and that taxation does get spent in ways that are good and, as you say, have local benefits. And I think maybe that ties a bit into the next question, the nuance of these stories, right? Because it's funny, you mentioned about media doing a better and better job of covering these issues. It's funny, but when I listen to the media, and maybe it's my bias from working in environmentalism, right? Like, I look at the media and I watch the news, and it seems to be about scandal. It seems to be about the biggest reveal or piece of drama. I'm curious, if we are back at a dialogue about environmental and energy solutions, great. But if not, if there's work to be done there, how would we get to maybe a more productive dialogue about it?
There's an excerpt from a new episode of The Environment in Canada. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by the new Between the Lines books release, Strangely Friends, A History of Cuban-Canadian Encounters by Karen Dubinsky. Find your copy at btlbooks.com and by Unrig. Learn more about Canada's coalition of 31 progressive publishers and get all the latest news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrig.ca. And by The Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archived episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now Blue Sky for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
My name is Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day. And plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.